This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Oh, it's a goal. Who got the assist? Who got the assist?
Hello. So welcome to one of our summer specials, a set of podcasts recorded in the summer break prior to the 2021-22 season. These podcasts delve deep and deep dive into an individual subject that influences FPL, the idea being to give you listeners a new perspective on the game you'll know and love, and maybe, just maybe, help you with your management for either the upcoming season or whenever you're listening to this, whatever time in the future you're in. Aided and abetted by some brilliant guests, we're hoping they'll be fascinating and rewarding to listen to if you do choose to put us in your ears. We've recorded podcasts on behavioral science, analytics, and fandom and FPL for this mini series. First up is the Behavioral Science Pod. So we are Who Got the Assist. You can find us on Twitter at WGTA_FPL, Anthony at FPL Stag, and also on Instagram, WGTA.FPL. Make sure to give us a follow on those channels, subscribe to our podcast and whatever source you use to get your podcast from. And if you enjoyed this, or indeed have enjoyed anything we've done over the past 5 years and haven't gotten around to it yet, please give us a 5-star review whenever you listen to these, as it's hugely appreciated and helps spread the word of the podcasts. So, mentioned it's Behavioural Science Day for the summer specials, and we're very happy to be joined by two amazing guests for this one. First is FPL_Raptor, otherwise known as Ross, who has burst onto the scene with his behavioural science and psychology insights over the last season, a part of the FPL Connect team, and with a book, which you should all have seen or heard about, and you definitely will be hearing about on this podcast. Welcome, Ross.
Hiya, Tom. Yep, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be on. Obviously, listened to a lot of the stuff you've done previously on psychology, or your previous episode with Simon on behavioral science. Read a lot of the articles on psychology. So I suppose you're the founder of discussing psychology and behavioral science in the community. Sport and exercise psychology is what I lecture in. My PhD is focused on skill acquisition and the use of virtual reality. So slightly more attentional and psychophysiological, moving away from cognitive and social psychology. But my background is very much in just kind of plain basic psychology. But I'm delighted to be on. So thanks for having me.
Excellent for this podcast then. And also we're joined once again by Simon March, the former winner of FPL and handily a behavioral economics aficionado. You can find him on Twitter at March. Simon, welcome back to the podcast, Simon. Great to have you on again.
Thanks again for having me.
Yeah, lads, it's absolutely great to have you both on. Thanks for joining us, Ross and Simon. It's a pleasure to have you for this summer special. The intersection between behavioral science and FPL, it's something that WGTA has touched on, and indeed more than touched on in the past, primarily, of course, thanks to Tom's experience in that area. But this in-depth focus on the topic should be really, really interesting, I think, for FPL managers who think about the game in its wider context. And so I guess making the most of having a guest who has literally wrote the book on this topic, we're going to lean on the structure that Ross uses in his book to break the application of behavioral science to FPL down by periods in and around any given game week. It's a great way for us to effectively touch on the many different ways that psychology plays a role in FPL management. And hopefully I think that everyone who's listening will enjoy it too. So without further ado, I guess, let's get cooking.
Yeah, let's get into it. So what is behavioral science? And we'll come on to Ross in a second because his background is slightly different. But simply put, behavioral science or behavioral economics takes the underlying principles of how humans behave according to economics and infuses them with a rationality. So trailblazers such as Daniel Kahneman, who wrote Thinking Fast and Slow, and Richard Taylor, the father of nudge theory, may have heard of, as well as many other academics such as Amos Tversky, they basically took issue with the pure economics view of how humans behave. That pure economics view is that humans behave and make decisions in the so-called econ way. That is, everything we do, we examine thoroughly, we weigh up all the outcomes and come to the best decision we can through careful analysis of all the evidence available to us to make ourselves the best little economic unit we could possibly be, otherwise known as maximizing utility. What behavioralists said was, hey, that's not true. The human brain is an ascended animal one designed for a simpler time when the barrage of messages and decisions we now make on a daily basis simply didn't exist. We're flawed, we're irrational, and as a result of all this information overload, basically, we utilize shortcuts. called Heuristics and Biases to help us navigate a cognitively complex world. We're essentially not Spock-like characters bent on maximizing our own economic output, and there's all kinds of influence on our behaviors. What's important to note here is that behavioral science is actually not one genre of work in and of itself, unlike, you know, literature or history or something like that. It's in fact a combination of many complementary ideas and theories from around academia, such as economics, of course, sociology, anthropology, and Ross's bag, psychology. More often than not, Ross, cognitive psychology.
Yes, so a brilliant introduction to behavioral science there. As Tom said, my background is more in psychology as opposed to behavioral science, but they do overlap in many ways. I suppose behavioral science is more focused on the decision making with a specific focus on economics. Psychology, very broadly, if you was to give it a very simple definition, would be the study of mind and behavior. It encompasses many things. It encompasses biological influences, social pressures, environmental factors that all affect how we think and how we act and how we feel. So anything that you're doing throughout your life, psychologists want to know more about. And within psychology, there are multiple facets, multiple subfields, such as biological psychology, cognitive psychology, social psychology. And in my master's and PhD, I'm moving into sports psychology, which attempts to look at the way that sportsmen act, feel, behave. So, I guess that's the key distinction between psychology and behavioral science.
I think, you know, one of the questions around behavioral sciences, it tends to be very interesting to listen to and to read about. You recognize a lot in yourself and you start to realize why you do the things that you do. But I suppose the remaining question is it useful to know this stuff? And one of the quotes that I've come across that I think encapsulates this that I really like is by a guy called Rory Sutherland. He says that the next revolution will not be technological, it will be psychological. And I think that's a really interesting perspective on it, because if you look at how lives and human potential were changed by things like the Industrial Revolution and the dawn of the internet, these things are still going to develop. Technology is still going to become more important and more efficient. But what behavioral science recognizes is that there's a lot of potential within humankind that is not currently being fulfilled. And in fact, a lot of the things that we've evolved over, you know, thousands of years are currently sabotaging our potential. So what behavioral science tries to do is identify where we are sabotaging ourselves and opportunities and methods by which we can improve and multiply our impact. Realistically, you can't expect a human to, even when they're aware of these biases and their effects, you can't really expect a human to compensate and to manage those things and, you know, recognize that they're being, you know, biased and making the right decision. I mean, the guys on this pod, yeah, we've probably read or thought about this about as much as anybody. And, you know, speaking for myself, at least, I know that I still make these mistakes and I can recognize them when I do them, but I still make them. And I probably still will continue to make them because, you know, that's just what it means to be human. If you want to encapsulate it's just a way of helping you get out of your own way and, you know, and fulfill your potential.
Absolutely. And I think we're beginning to get into the whole kind of fantasy football realm there in terms of making mistakes and continuing to make them. So let's get into the main body of it. And I guess, as Anthony mentioned earlier, and in Ross's book, the structure really is about a game week in the season. So, you know, not game week one, not game week 38, or not like a special other sort of game week, like a double game week, but a regular game week. Let's call this game week 13, shall we? An innocuous game week, but everyone's going to forget, you know, an ordinary week as far as things can be. So what we're going to do is structure this podcast around the game week in the season, just to make it easier and keep us tight and focused. We can, as I mentioned, go into the weeds of stuff like the psychology of chip strategy, but that's coverable in Ross's book. And in interest of not doing a 3-4 hour podcast, I think we'll try to make it as typical a week as possible, as I said. So that game week 13 is what we're going to go for. We're going to split this into four phases, which is early in the week. So when you're doing your research, you know, a little bit out from deadline. Later in the week, when you're making your final decisions, about to press confirm on those transfers and proclaim, I'm locked in play, and after the game week. So, you know, post hoc thoughts and some ways to deal with a bad game week too. We're going to talk through a few of the key heuristics and biases that can impact managers at each stage of this game week. But there is one overarching caveat to all of this. You know how much I love a caveat. But I'm going to leave it to somebody else to deliver it, because linking into what Simon said there about even though you identify with it, you still make mistakes. There's one big one here, which Ross really nicely puts in his book, which is bias, blind spot. And Ross, would you want to just explain that? Because I love it. It's the most meta point ever, isn't it, when we're doing a podcast like this?
Yeah, it's brilliant. It's quite humorous. It's sort of a nice soft way to start the pod, to start the book. So bias, blind spot, essentially is the idea that we can recognize the impact of biases in the judgment of other people. So you can point to someone on Twitter and go, ha, they're demonstrating confirmation bias, but you really struggle to recognize the same bias in yourself. So there's a nice quote from Prolin, Lin and Ross. They discuss it as an asymmetry in perceived susceptibility to biases. So there's this asymmetry between what you can recognize in yourself and what you can recognize in others. So essentially we are blind to our own biases. And it's a very nice point to consider as we'll be going through this pod, because I think we'll mention probably 10, 15 different biases, potentially even more. And you may be thinking to yourself as you're listening to this, well, no, that's not me. I don't suffer from that cognitive bias. Other people do, but I don't. And if you are thinking that to yourself, I'd modestly suggest that maybe you're suffering from the bias blind spot. So it's something nice to keep in mind as you're listening.
You make the point really well, actually, in the book, and this just maybe ties it off nicely, that most people think they're better than average at stuff. And that just kind of sums it up nicely. It's, you know,
yeah, absolutely. Like,
and not everyone is better than average at whatever it might be.
It's called illusory superiority. We have this illusion that we are superior to other people. And I mean, some of us will be. And I'm sure we'd like to think that we are superior at certain things throughout the FPL season. And with respect to our own domains, especially psychology for me, I'd like to have that illusion of superiority. But we do need to consider that sometimes we're not as superior as we may think.
Essentially, we're all human here. And I don't think any of us propagate immune to falling prey from the things we're going to be speaking about. It's easy to think we may think we are because we're describing them and talking about them. But that's really not the case. So bias blind spot is a great thing to throw off the top. So let's set the scene. It's early in the week with last game week's outcome still high in mind. And you know, you've got a bit of time, barring if you've made any raise transfers, of course, in terms of your next move and decisions. As I said, it's a bit of an innocuous sort of game week 13. There's nothing out of the ordinary as far as things can be these days, of course. And FPL-wise, you're probably doing things like listening to podcasts, reading articles, maybe match reports as well, summarising the weekend just gone, tweeting, you know, reading tweet threads, having discussions on Twitter, or you know, chatting to your mates on the WhatsApp group, something like that, about the week that was. So at this point in the game week sort of cycle, I guess there are a few sort of overpowering sort of things which do kind of creep in. The first one I think is pretty well known, nonetheless worth discussing, which is that fantastic idea of herd mentality. I've mentioned this quite a few times in the past on this podcast, but it is the idea of the twin impulse of greed and fear from an evolutionary standpoint. Imagine you're a cave person and food's been brought back to your cave. Those kind of two impulses kick in for you. Greed, you know, you want to keep yourself strong and be able to pass your genes on to the next generation. And equally fear, you need to eat to survive and not be weakened. And FPL points work in exactly the same way. So you want the points that others are scoring for yourself, of course, to be in a stronger position. And you don't want to lose out and lose rank for not getting those points. Solomon Ash in 1995, in the conformity experiment, actually proved the existence of herd mentality. In this experiment, a group of people were all told to give the wrong answer to a very basic question, except one person who wasn't in on the experiment, not a Confederate, as they delightfully put it. And that person was asked last. All these questions were really, really basic, stuff like, it's all American, so what is the capital of the USA? You know, that sort of level of question. You'd expect the last person to be thinking, no, you know what, something's wrong here. But almost every time, Ash found that the last person, they always gave the same glaring wrong answer as their peers gave. And there's kind of, you know, the influence of peer pressure, information, and it also kind of speaks to the core of how things like fake news can spread. If misinformation is believed by everyone around you, you are likelier to believe it yourself. And we're exposed to the herd in many ways. Ownership, especially effective ownership, which has become huge over the last kind of couple of seasons. The transfer market, you see what everyone else is doing. Captain polls, and obviously Twitter content, articles, podcasts, recommending certain players or teams. So a whole gamut of herd mentality stuff going on, isn't there, Ross? And I mean, it is something you can kind of sit back and kind of watch Twitter from an ethnographic perspective and just observe it sort of happening. It really is fascinating, isn't it?
Absolutely. And the generation we're in, social media has just amplified everything. All of these incredible psychological concepts and behavioral science concepts we'll be talking about today, obviously, when they came into prevalence, social media wasn't anything like it was now. And so we almost need to do all of our research again now through social media. And I mean, you can think of it as like a simile, where sort of your thoughts are your phone, and you plug that in for an aux lead, and then social media is the speaker, and it amplifies everything. It makes everything more intense. So I think as you're on social media, as I know Tom likes to do and I like to do, and I'm sure Simon does as well, let's take a step back and just have a look at the sort of processes that you might see on social media. And you can see that the sort of things that you would see in everyday life are amplified even further. And herd mentality in particular, because it's the idea that we don't want to disrupt harmony within the group. The community is an incredible place and we do act like a community. And sometimes randomly calling someone out for an opinion or a captaincy choice or a transfer would disrupt that harmony. And as such, that's why we like to take a step back and avoid disrupting the harmony. But in doing so, we're not suggesting logical alternatives and we're not challenging the status quo. So I think I'd recommend, if possible, do challenge, do recommend other alternatives, do try and spark up that discussion. Obviously do so in a very polite way and don't cause unnecessary aggro. But yeah, do try to challenge it and don't just take a step back and think, well, if everyone's doing it, all these top managers are making the same decision, then surely I should do the same thing. Because if we don't come up with these alternatives, then we're just going to all be suffering from herd mentality.
Certainly. And Anthony, you're always famously going against the grain when it comes to things like chip strategy and things like that. It's fair to say that you and Nick both spend less time on social media than I do. I mean, do you find that kind of insulates you to some extent from herd mentality? Like, do I say things on this podcast that you kind of think, God, that's just Twitter rubbish, isn't it? So
there have certainly been times where I was maybe not quite as active as you on Twitter, but a lot more active than I am now. And I think I definitely found that the herd mentality got to me then. And I think that is something that is touched upon with the idea of herd mentality, that it often can be amplified by social interactions or by social media, I guess, is the arch social interaction of the modern age. And I found that for sure. And sometimes you come out with things on the pod and I'm thinking, no, that's definitely taken off on Twitter this week. Like, why are we talking about captaining Raheem Sterling? Like, he hasn't been good in a year. And that's the sort of thing that does come out. So yeah, I definitely do see that herd mentality coming through. And I do think that social interactions play a huge, huge part in it.
With respect to the community, I mean, it's taking on a new dimension with Twitter becoming more popular with FPL. But I mean, yeah, for a really long time, I always thought that for all the tools that are available to help FPL managers, the best tool is still the FPL community. And to some extent, I still believe that. But then there's another part of me that actually thinks it's also just the absolute worst tool possible. And that there is a wisdom of crowds and things like the captaincy poll, which obviously brings together and kind of weaponizes groupthink a bit, you know, can often have a very positive effect. And it is just useful, you know, quite apart from the fact that it, you know, it's quite a nice social thing to do most of the time. It is useful to be able to, you know, have your ideas sense checked by people, you know. But I mean, one thing I don't know about the guy who won it this year, but before this year, you know, one thing that really stood out to me was that nobody who had ever won FPL had done so whilst being active on Twitter. And you know, maybe that's a correlation more than a causation, but I could definitely see with respect to the power of groupthink and social norms to take you off in some really weird directions. I'm not surprised that somebody who insulates themselves from that kind of thing can really benefit from it. I mean, you do see some real nonsense, and it doesn't always appear like nonsense at the time, but you see how quickly it can take off. That suddenly a player who there's no actual real rational basis for it or logical basis for it being a good pick.
Yes.
You know, I mean, a couple of people start to, you know, talk about them, and then suddenly, before you know it, they're an absolute must have and they're the most transferred in player.
I'm seeing the spectre of Shane Duffy appearing over a hill, and us all slapping the armband on the strapping Irishman's upper arm. I know exactly what you mean, Simon, and it definitely can warp your perception. I think there's been numerous sort of semi-mathematical studies which have shown that it's like FPL is like 1% of the population or something like that of playing FPL. And obviously like a good proportion of the top 1% is going to be within that sort of sphere. But nonetheless, it's definitely a really interesting area, and it can definitely kind of shape and bend your perceptions away from kind of what the best call is towards what the common sort of grain is. And I think that kind of nicely links actually to the common knowledge effect as well. So this kind of made me think of Game of Thrones, you know, it is known. This is really powerful actually, because it can lead to you, similar to herd mentality in the group think, just accepting something as a gospel truth without actually looking into it yourself, because you just hear sort of things all the time where people say, no, this has happened so many times in the past, it's definitely true, it's going to happen again. And that also links to quite a few other things we'll speak about later on, where this guy is the obvious captain and that kind of ends the debate.
Double game week against Bournemouth and Cardiff is a perfect time to captain a Brighton defender is the
yeah. And you know, there's definitely like you know, a whole world of things there that we can speak about. For example, jobs to be done theory, which states that outsourcing the task of thinking to other people is what's happened here. But yeah, I mean, common knowledge for us, that's an interesting one, especially when sort of contrasted with another thing that you can observe, which is group polarization.
Yeah, common knowledge is interesting because it's the idea that we all share a certain amount of knowledge. Perhaps the FPL community will have 70%, 80% of the same knowledge, and we all discuss that knowledge quite a lot. It links to group thinking because we want to kind of maintain that harmony. We don't want to bring in logical alternatives, and we don't want to discuss these additions that might actually bring something new to the table. So the common knowledge effect is the fact that we just basically on Twitter will all discuss the same things that we already know, and that we won't bring these new exciting things to the table. It does lead quite nicely onto group polarization. Group polarization isn't focused on the actual content of the decision of the community. It's more focused on how extreme the decision will be. So focus on the word polarization. When we discuss things in groups and specifically on social media, we tend to polarize towards the more extreme. So you can imagine in FPL, if we're all discussing captain in a differential at the start of the week, maybe someone that's 15% owned. We start having these discussions, and the more we discuss it on social media, the more likely it goes from being, oh, we could possibly captain this differential, to it's the obvious choice, and it becomes more and more extreme. And it's not necessarily just going from, oh, it could be an option, to it's the obvious option. It can then even go further, and you can think, well, is there someone that's even more of a differential? So group polarization, you need to be very careful. The more you discuss things, and I'm thinking about Hindu Monkey and his Che Adams train, and the idea of this train coming through. And the idea of a train and a bandwagon is that we start off with a very, very basic idea and a very, very small minority influence, small concept. And the more we discuss it in the community, the more extreme it becomes until it becomes the obvious choice. And that's when out of nowhere, you just get a player that doesn't look like they've got a great fixture with not very good underlying stats being captained by 50% of the top 10K. So it's definitely an interesting concept.
Yeah, the group polarization idea actually kind of, it chimed in with kind of maybe discussions of politics in the last few years and the idea of, you know, silos, people who are in a bubble in social media that tends to drive them towards quite extreme ideas over time. And it's, we can see the same thing happen in FPL. And so that Overton window shifts as to what is, you know, a viable or feasible strategy. And we start to see people then discussing, okay, Man City have a good fixture, and it goes from just captain De Bruyne to captain Sterling to what about Cancelo or Stones or Diaz or even Ederson, because, you know, maybe they'll get a penalty against them and he'll save it, of course. You know, this sort of like daft stuff does start to happen, and we see it all the time.
Yeah, an esoteric pick will come out, and you know, I will praise this fairly often, as I'm sure you will recount from various podcasts over the last 4 or 5 years, where there's been an obvious pick, a less obvious pick, and a ridiculously unobvious pick. And guess what I've done? I've gone for the 1% player who shows up for 20 minutes or something like that. And I think, Simon, this kind of links in nicely to what you were saying earlier on, doesn't it, about kind of the nature of FPL Twitter and kind of how herd mentality, common knowledge, and group polarization could all have different sort of distortion effects on your own sense of thinking. And I like what you said about the winners.
Yeah, when this happens, when you get these kind of mini bubbles in FPL, and a whole bunch of people go in a certain direction, and if you can spot it, if you can tell that they're, you know, they're on a hide into nothing, and you can avoid that, that's actually differential in itself. And I always thought about, you know, looking back on the season that I won it, one thing that struck me was that I don't remember really picking anybody that you would describe as a major differential. I felt that most of the players that I picked were fairly sensible. But what I realized looking back on it is that what I managed to do, it was avoid a lot of these bandwagons that ended up getting derailed very quickly. And that was really enough. That ended up being the difference between, you know, my season and somebody who didn't do quite as well that year. So it's not always necessarily a case of, you know, finding this diamond in the rough, you know, this real differential. It's some of the time it's just about not getting sucked into these bandwagons that, you know, drag you in a negative direction.
All right, let's move on a little bit then to anchoring. Anchoring is basically the idea that the first thing you see plays an outsized role in your perceptions, as that's the yardstick you compare everything else with. To give you an example, from the retail world, there was a famous ploy from the noughties where, say you were going to buy a TV and you went to an electronics store. Often the one they want to ship, the mid-price TV, would be the very first thing that they place in the store. So, you know, you'd see it, you see the price, you'd see what it did and all that sort of thing. It would be kind of mid-price. So you'd walk around the store and you see cheaper ones, more expensive ones. And what people always do is they land on the middle one because they've anchored their perception of what a price of a TV should be based on the first thing that they saw. And from the off-ross, there's loads of ways that this impacts FPL managers, aren't there?
Absolutely. And I think content creators could actually use this to make their podcasts and to make their articles and to make their threads more appealing to the masses, the order in which we receive information. The podcasts that tend to drop on a Monday or a Tuesday, the first things you'll see, they're the pieces of information that you'll remember throughout the week. And as you're going through the transfers and someone suggests potentially something on a Thursday, you see a Twitter thread that's, and you think, oh, but I remember on the podcast on the Monday, someone suggested something else and it was actually a really good idea. So I think I'll stick to that. And the issue we've got with anchoring bias is it's very difficult to differentiate between anchoring bias and gut feeling. Because we say, I've got this gut feeling at the start of the week. I've got a gut feeling that I'm going to captain Marcus Rashford because I think it's going to explode this weekend. It's very difficult to try and understand, are you sticking to your gut feeling by captaining Marcus Rashford, or are you experiencing anchoring bias? And even more than that, there's another bias called plan continuation bias, which is the idea that we just continue with a plan because it was the original plan, even though more logical alternatives are coming up. So you've got all these things coming up in your mind. You have your plan at the beginning of the week, and you've got to try and decide as an FPL manager, what bias are you experiencing? Or are you just sticking to your plan like you should be? Are you just trusting your gut feeling? And obviously for us guys that know these biases, these are the sort of things that are going through our mind every week. But there's not a sort of one size fits all answer. It changes each week, but you do need to consider whether the plan that you had at the start of the week is what is influencing your eventual plan that you come to decide at the end of the week.
No, absolutely. I mean, we'll definitely get on to your gut later on. That's a huge part, obviously, of how this all fits together.
With respect to anchoring, just another side of it that I think manifests itself in FPL is in how we determine the value of something. We tend to do it on a very sort of relative but somewhat arbitrary basis. And an example from my own life at the moment is that I'm currently buying a house. And if you've ever bought a house, you realize that because you're spending a lot of money on one thing, that suddenly other things that you would have thought were really expensive, like lawyer's fees and survey costs and things like this, suddenly you're just, you know, writing these checks.
Yeah, I've just moved. I feel that exact pain.
And not even thinking about it. And that's because you're kind of anchored on the you know, on the big number, which is the house. And I see this in FPL quite a lot in how we determine, you know, whether a player is overpriced or not. I remember back in after Harry Kane's first season, I think he was something like 4.5, something ridiculous in his first season. So he's an incredible value. And in his next season, he went up to 9 million. And I distinctly remember a lot of conversation around that as to whether he was worth it at 9 million. And obviously, he proved that he was. But he was even worth it the season before. But because people had got used to the idea of Harry Kane being a 4.5 player, it was very difficult for them to then shift their minds to accept him as a 9 million player. And it, you know, we see it in how we assess you know, performance in terms of goal scoring. You know, if a player scored 30 goals one season, 20 goals the next season, you know, we start to think that you know, they're on the decline, but actually, you know, 20 goals independently is a fantastic return. So I think, you know, there are a lot of ways in which anchoring seems to affect us.
Absolutely. I mean, Anthony, this is definitely something that, you know, I'll see from you that you'll kind of say one thing at the start of the week, and you appear to be very good at, by the end of the week, changing your mind completely and going something completely off the wall when you post your team in our Slack at 5 minutes before the deadline. I mean, do you recognise anchoring bias as much as someone who's not as into it as we are? Like, is it something that you would recognise?
Yeah, I've done one module on behavioral economics in college. I'm an expert, man. No, I haven't a clue. So no, I just play along as I go, I guess. And I think maybe it's just the idea that I tend to make my decisions on Thursdays and Fridays in FPL. And I happily do research for the podcast on a Sunday or a Monday or a Tuesday, whatever day it might be, but I don't really have a plan. And then, you know, the end of the podcast comes and you're like, Anthony, and what's your plan? And I'm like, oh, I'll just make up something. Sometimes is the position where I'm in, or sometimes I can kind of see what looks logical at that point, but I want to see some Champions League games or something to really know what I feel like I'm actually going to do when the week goes on. So I think for me, it's more that there isn't a plan to continue. And like, whilst I might have set out a bus team, that isn't the plan. And so I don't get too anchored into a thought. I think, though, maybe what does happen to me is more, I might as well toss in one of the other biases that we've come across. That's that Semmelweis, which is, you know, it's like that conservatism bias, but it's more that it's that tendency to reject new information that contradicts something that I've already come in to believe or that I've taken in before. And that might have been something that I've taken in over, you know, the course of a season.
So Semmelweis reflex is what this is called. And the story behind this is Ignaz Semmelweis, who was a Hungarian physician who gives his name to this particular psychological foible. The story goes in the 19th century, Semmelweis realized that child mortality rates in the hospital he worked at dramatically fell if fellow doctors washed their hands in chlorine disinfectant before going to see the mothers of the children. And it sounds incredible today, but in those times, doctors thought nothing of not washing their hands between doing an autopsy and seeing an expectant mother. Anyway, Semmelweis tried to tell them they had to kind of change their ways. They had to kind of adapt because it wasn't working. But the reaction of the doctors was predictably resistant. They believed, for example, gentlemen could not pass on illnesses. The idea behind this is obviously sticking to what we know. This can be either a blessing or a curse. Sometimes it is a bit of a curse. So, you know, it can mean you're a bit slow to accept changes in the game or in a player. See the likes of Patrick Bamford, Danny Ings or Jay Lings, you know, people including us have written off these guys, have busted flushes from what we knew. And we weren't able to jump on the bandwagon as quick as we otherwise could have been.
Like last season, the classic example for me would have been that I had kind of decided that Son was overperforming. And I just continued to project over and over again that he was outperforming his XG. It was just something that I could not possibly internalize. And I think that's more the sort of thing that, you know, affects me as opposed to being anchored to one plan. But I can totally understand how people can be anchored to, you know, big spreadsheet plans that they put together over the course of like 3 weeks with all these fixtures put in and that they want to stick with just because maybe they put the effort into making the spreadsheet or because the plan seemed so great at the start, they settled on it and now they can't escape it.
I think we're going to have to throw in sunk cost fallacy here, I think. I think we're getting too close to it, so I'm going to have to do it. Mm. But basically, it's basically all these things. So the concept that you invest a certain amount of resource into something, which means you don't want to give up on it too easily, which is exactly that. There are essentially costs that can't be recovered, be they time, money, whatever, hence sunk costs. And there's a great study by Arks and Bloomer who demonstrated sunk cost fallacy of the 1980s with their famous ski trip example. Ross, you mentioned it in your book as well. And subjects were asked to imagine they had basically spent $100 of the ski trip to one resort, but they're off on a better trip elsewhere for $50 and booked that too. They're asked what they do if the timings clash. Neither were refundable. Which one would they go on? They all basically chose the more expensive trip. It wasn't as good, but the loss seemed greater. They didn't want to lose that sunk cost. And we see it all the time in FPL. The depth of my research shows this. I'm taking a strong position on social media, so I need to kind of follow that through, remembering that group polarization effect we just spoke about. Or even idiots uttering on podcasts a very strong position that they feel like they need to then back up and double down on in public, often to their own detriment because an optimal solution presents itself, which is much more obvious. Things, you know, that probably weren't the best things to do, but because you've basically dug a hole for yourself effectively or put loads of time into presenting a case something, you feel like you've got to go through with it.
This really demonstrates itself in the real world. You know, one of the things that sunk cost fallacy causes us to do is throw good money after bad. Yeah, that we double down on it. And so it's something that gamblers experience. If you're down, then you might as well keep on going down. You know, rather than acknowledge the amount that you've lost and cut your losses, you end up just losing more most of the time in an attempt to win it back. And I think that we see that a lot in FPL, particularly with hit taking. You take a certain number of hits to get your team looking a certain way, and then suddenly it becomes quite permissive. They sometimes call it the cascade effect. You know, once you've started to do something or once you've invested or you feel like you've invested something in it, then suddenly you become much more inclined to keep throwing points at it, or yeah, in this case, throwing points at it or throwing money at it in the real world. You know, that is definitely an element that manifests itself within FPL. In terms of what you can do about it, it's very difficult because it's so natural, but I think being aware of it is a key thing, and sometimes sort of structuring yourself. So, I mean, I use the example of taking hits. One form of structure that you could do to help manage that and to help regulate it would be to say, okay, I'm only going to take 4 hits this season. And even if you end up taking, you know, 20 hits, it's still the case that every time that you do that, you'll be very conscious of doing it, and you'll be less sort of blasé about it, less, you know, what the hell, I've taken one, so I might as well take some more. So I just think that giving yourself that extra reason to think about it, it can be really beneficial in managing that particular fallacy.
Another piece of advice, just to top that off for this whole section, is just to be a dynamic and adaptive manager. And I think all of these plan continuation bias, gut feeling, anchoring bias, if you're willing to be dynamic throughout the week, and as Simon said, you try and your best to acknowledge that you can be prone to these biases. Okay. Try to avoid the bias blind spot. If you do realize that throughout the week and you try your best to be dynamic and adaptive, you are more likely to be able to notice these biases and to stop yourself from falling victim to them. So I suppose as a mantra throughout your game week, especially in the early stages as you're doing your research, just try and think to yourself, I'm going to be as adaptive and dynamic as possible. And I'm going to be willing to respond to new information, but not necessarily so willing that I'm going to throw out the pieces of information that I've learned earlier in the week.
Right. So yeah, no, really interesting discussion overall there, I think, of just after the game which finished, and that's kind of early stage of the next game week, this kind of game week 13, the pre-game week sort of time. I mean, which one of the myriad of things we've already discussed, guys, do you think are the biggest influences out there? I think common knowledge effect is increasingly growing in impact just because of the situation we've all found ourselves in recently. I think that there's been so many people who are part of FPL now, you know, whether they're active on Twitter or not, who are kind of involved reading articles, you know, listening to podcasts, the growth of people who are kind of shadow boxing, as it were, using, you know, the templates of teams from the likes of FPL General and so on and so forth, to outsource their decisions to those guys and just kind of use that as a template for what they should be doing. And I think that creates kind of a critical mass, as Anthony and I mentioned in the final podcast of last season, with things like effective ownership, which increasingly makes a maverick move more and more difficult, or at least incredibly scary to do. Simon, which one do you reckon it is for you?
Groupthink, social norms, FOMO, or fear of missing out. You know, this is something that can be directly related to what you see on things like social media. And the more you see it, the more difficult it is to resist that. And, you know, we've seen it throughout history. I mean, you know, things like tulip mania and subprime mortgages and Beanie Babies and meme stocks, maybe Bitcoin, Theo Walcott, all these things over time have all been things that, you know, started off as conversations online and ended up being, you know, massive bubbles, massive bandwagons, and they wouldn't keep happening if they were easy to avoid. And I think that when we talk about groupthink and social norms and fear of missing out, this is the root of those things.
I guess taking a slightly more kind of just amateur man on the fence, just taking all this in and maybe trying to apply it to the FPL Twitter community, maybe on the fly more, I do think we definitely obviously see groupthink at play. And this is something we talk about on the pod quite frequently, and that people are being herded towards decisions. And part of that as well is, as Tom said, about the common knowledge effect, that people are copying teams. But I think something like polls, for example, which point people towards who to captain, I think do that in a much more, you know, minute way compared to people actually copying teams, you know, writ large across a whole season. But then maybe when we look at content producers on Twitter, we definitely see polarization becoming a thing, that people are almost using the fact that it's possible to suggest mad things and actually be seen as a bit of a maverick and perhaps somebody who takes risks and does well and play on that shock value to kind of grow themselves. And I think that's definitely something we see on Twitter more and more. And maybe there's an aspect of that Semmelweis reflex as well coming into things. And I know I'm just like, I'm hitting on most of the ones that we talked about now, but people rejecting new information. And the reason why I think sometimes people are rejecting new information that comes in, which contradicts their original view, is that they feel like their personal worth is tied up in the team that they have already, or the transfers that they've made already, or in the case of content producers, the calls that they've made on a podcast or in an article before or earlier in the season that they say must keep going. So I guess I would point to all three, but I think groupthink is by far and away the one that's driving the ship.
In my opinion, the two that stand out for me in my own behaviours and the stuff that I see on social media is probably a combination of plan continuation bias and the Semmelweis reflex. It's the idea that we have this plan at the beginning of the week or the beginning of the month. We do all this research, sunk cost fallacy, we invest in that, and then we reject the new information that disagrees with our plan. So it's a combination of plan continuation bias, Semmelweis reflex, and sunk cost fallacy. I would say those three. And the best way to counter that is to, as I said before, just try and be as dynamic and adaptive as possible as an FPL manager.
Really, really good advice. I think that's probably the main outtake from me from doing this, from what Simon said and what Ross has said, is that just trying to make sure you don't get settled on an idea too quickly, trying to make sure that you don't fall prey to these sorts of things as far as you possibly can, bias blind spot in mind, is probably the way to go in the early stage of the game week. We're going to have a break now. When we come back, we'll talk about later on in the game week, crunch time.
Who got the assist?
So we're back and it's still game week 13. But we've come away from, say, Monday to Wednesday, where we're digesting what happened and so on. And, you know, we're making up our own decisions. We're thinking about who we're going to be captioning. We're getting close to pressing confirm on that all-important transfer in. And there's lots of different things which sort of come into play here. One of the ones that I really want to throw in before we do anything is the importance of framing, which is kind of using stats, misusing stats or other kind of relevant data to frame your argument. Ross does a great example of this in his book, and I did the same a while back when I did a psychology corner on this. But it's a really kind of pertinent thing to bear in mind when you look at any data which presented as an argument for why a player is worth buying or captioning. Here's a conundrum listeners can definitely all guess the answer to. I'm going to tell you about two players now. So player one, last season, this player had a great campaign. He scored 15 goals, nabbed 14 assists, showing his centrality to the team. He played 31.5 games worth of time and managed a massive 187 points, meaning a hugely impressive points per game of 5.9. Impressively, he scored 15 goals from just 38 shots on target, showing his predatory nature in front of goal. He was also a creative player this year, a new string to his bow, 14 assists from 9 big chances created, and next A of 7 was just fantastic. He's a must-own next season. In contrast, player 2 last season was inconsistent and simply unreliable, you know. He scored 8 less goals last year than the year before, and his points total dropped off markedly from 2019-20 when he scored 23 points more than did this year, so a decrease of 10%. He was profligate in front of goal as well, you know. He was missing over half his big chances, overperforming his XG by a large margin. More than half of his goals also came from the penalty spot this year. 8 of his goals. Over the last 12 game weeks of the 2021 season, he blanked in 9 of those games, showing his unreliability. And he was often left second fiddle as a new strike partner seems to take the limelight. He's definitely one to avoid next season as he's overperforming and simply can't keep this up. Both those players are Jamie Vardy. So it's just a way of kind of encapsulating how you can frame data to put your argument forward. And I think, Ross, this is one you touched on in your book, but a really nice way to kick off this sort of discussion of when you get to crunch time, how you make your decisions can definitely be kind of framed by the data you read and the spin you put on it to suit your arguments.
Absolutely. And I love that example of using the same player because it's the same stats. And it's such an interesting conversation because a lot of people will see these biases that we're discussing today and they'll say, well, probably the best way to do it is just to avoid that subjectivity and to just go for objective stats instead. Well, I'll just look at underlying stats because they're objective and they paint the picture. But of course, whilst the stats are objective, it's all about your subjective interpretation of the stats. Because stats by themselves do nothing. We have to then interpret them and then make the choice on which player we want to transfer into captain. So it's that subjective interpretation, which once again, then turns the stats into something that isn't objective. So something very, very worthwhile looking at. And we're going to come on to some other biases here as well. Just worth noting that while stats are objective, we do interpret them in a very subjective manner.
Yeah, so researcher bias, I think, is another kind of way of putting that. I think you mentioned that in your book as well, Ross. You know, like obviously, you know, the eye test is something that's held up as being very subjective. And as you kind of say, the stats are kind of often said, you know, these are objective, put on a pedestal in that way. but the way in which you approach the problem still skews the data in a certain way. And it's also interesting to see if this extends to the academic world, for example. So Josh Miller's recent work on hot-hand fallacy, which probably won't speak about here, but Simon spoke about on the last podcast we did in terms of behavioral science. But he recently looked at other work by Amos Tversky back in the day and found elements of researcher bias in how they presented their data to disprove the fact that hot hand fallacy existed. So it is definitely one of those things which does permeate all aspects of how you interpret data. Moving on to a couple of kind of well-wrought areas in terms of deciding what research matters to you. Confirmation bias is a big one that everybody kind of knows about, is referenced by all manner of individuals, be they content providers or, you know, just FPL accounts. And this is a phenomenon of when you're doing your research to home in on and overvalue information which backs up your point of view, and also you block out or discard information which runs to the contrary, linking with anchoring, things like that. But the effect is that you see stuff online and you're focusing on RMTs with your player in them, and you kind of tend to favor those arguments which are framed to back your point of view up. And this also links to something called belief bias, you know, judging the strength of an argument based on how well its conclusion is argued versus how well the actual data supports said argument. And Anthony, we see this a lot, don't we? And I think that we probably are guilty on the podcast of indulging in this, because we are kind of, you know, looking for a bit of an angle on how we present things. And often we can fall prey to this and next week just be like, oh God, I can't believe we said that guy looks good. Oh, wow. And that definitely links into other things that we've spoken about in the previous episodes, you know, things like common knowledge or the herd mentality in the group thing.
It is an interesting one, Tom. And I've been thinking about it a little bit, because you could argue we're succumbing to confirmation bias and just seeking out the information that backs up our view or backs up the point that we want to make on the podcast about a player, which isn't necessarily the same thing as our view. Sometimes, you know, sometimes we're trying to provide a devil's advocate opinion on the other side to, you know, I know how you're going to go on a player, Tom. So sometimes I'll give the devil's advocate opinion to make sure that the listener hears both sides. But you do find that unless you've got that dynamic where you've got a devil's advocate approach, it's sometimes very, very hard to swim through all the data by yourself. And I think this is definitely a thing which affects threads on Twitter more than anything, where often, you know, because there is that small area or small number of words to get through a point, you often find that really only one position can be put forward on a given comparison of players, which isn't necessarily helpful. And sometimes, because if you say, you know, in the last six game weeks, he's always scored away from home. But if it turns out that there was only one game away from home, but it isn't very easy to see that in a Twitter thread, you know, you just take this like stat taken as it was and you think, oh, wow, this guy's great away from home. I should definitely captain him. And then it turns out that that might not necessarily have anywhere near the same value that it should have. And is that confirmation bias? Is that someone just maybe not doing their homework? Or is that at the end of the day, the person who's taking, you know, taking out that information, me in this example, not doing the research for myself and falling prey to someone else's confirmation bias?
Yeah, outsourcing that kind of thinking to somebody else. I mean, Ross, what do you reckon here? You put a few really nice vignettes about this in your book. I mean, what's the view from a learned opinion?
I find it very interesting. And I like that Anthony's touched on Twitter threads there, because Twitter threads, you can often combine confirmation bias and belief bias, because I would be lying if I say that I don't often skip toward the end of a thread, read the conclusion. And if the conclusion is something that I want, if the conclusion is that I should captain Bruno Fernandes, I want to captain Bruno Fernandes, I'll go through and read the thread. If the bottom, the conclusion says don't captain Bruno, I'll go, well, that's a stupid thread, and I'll scroll past that. And there you've got belief bias at the start, and then you've got confirmation bias, because you're like, oh, if they've said captain Bruno, I want some evidence that it is indeed the correct choice. This is one of the more difficult, I mean, Simon's touched on it throughout, how difficult it is to spot these biases in ourselves. And if it was easy, then we wouldn't be having this conversation right now, because everyone would be able to avoid them. This is one that you just have to do your best to try and be aware of. I urge everyone to try not to skip towards the end of a thread or an article or a podcast and listen to the conclusion. Try and listen to the main body or read the main body and form your own conclusion. Because sometimes you'll read the body of an argument, you'll form a conclusion, and then you'll read the conclusion and you'll say, well, that conclusion doesn't match the stats at all. Yeah. And then I think that's the best way to do it, is to look at it in that fashion.
Absolutely. I think also there's links to something called the clustering illusion, which as a quant trained guy, it often pains me, but I'm far too nice to point it out, how poor some analysis I see is. And there's often a reliance on a tiny sample set of data to prove a very individualized point. You're backing a player on your team or a player that you've bought. Anthony's mentioned a couple of these stuff like last year. I think you said in your book, Ross, Jack Grealish every 3 weeks has a double-digit haul. That's a great example of that, where people kind of look at a set of random data and basically try to transpose on that a sense of non-randomness. I think there is a trend, there's a pattern there. And in fact, that doesn't really exist, does it? And I think that that's definitely one of those things which we see a lot in those sort of Twitter threads.
Yeah, and Simon wrote a fantastic article. I mean, he can speak about it himself on the correlation causation fallacy, and it links in perfectly there. We see these are clustering illusions. We see stats and we try to impose some sort of meaning to them. And sometimes it's just a correlation. Sometimes these two events just occur side by side. It doesn't necessarily mean that every time Jack Grealish plays his third match, he's going to get a double-digit haul. It just means it just so happens there's a correlation. They occur side by side. That when Jack Grealish plays his third game, he tends to have a massive haul. But there's no causation there. And I mean, Simon can touch on that himself, but it's a very, very interesting concept that correlation does not imply causation.
It's really interesting how automatic these things can be. If I'm looking at a fantasy football forum and I've got an idea in my head of what kind of player I want to bring in, I say I'm considering Harvey Barnes or whatever, my eyes will be automatically drawn to rate my teams with Harvey Barnes in it, and that'll make me feel better about picking him. Even if they're the minority, it will still make me feel better to know that somebody else is looking at it as well. And that really is confirmation bias. But I mean, I even do it proactively. Sometimes I'll be thinking of that player and I'll search for them on Twitter. And I'll actually seek out people who are considering the same player. Again, that'll just be to make me feel better about my decision. And yeah, it kind of goes back a little bit to that outsourcing. It's not always just outsourcing the decision process. It's outsourcing the ramifications of it. You know, if it goes wrong, at least you know that other people have made the same mistake. And, you know, that's a very sort of permissive sort of behavior. But yeah, with regards to statistics, I mean, I probably shouldn't be saying this given how much we talk about them, but I honestly don't think that they're anywhere near as useful throughout the season as we make out football is. One of these sports where you don't have that sort of critical mass of data, except for at the very beginning of the season, where there are all sorts of other factors, but you can still look back at the entire data set of the previous season or seasons, or at the very end of the season. Between those two poles, I don't think that the data that we see is very instructive at all. I think a lot of the time we're looking at things like, okay, that player scored last week, so he's more likely to score this week. And you know, sometimes we even think the opposite. We think that a player didn't score last week, so he's more likely to score this week. We're looking at very small pieces of data and we're extrapolating from those to try and find meaning and narratives within it. And, you know, a lot of the time we're not doing that just because we're not trained or skilled at using data. We're doing it because of necessity. We don't have a ton of data like you would have in games like baseball, for example.
Narrative bias, creating a narrative that does not exist. I think that's definitely something which we see a lot. And I think that feeds into what we were saying earlier on as well about, you know, a random differential coming out of left field, suddenly becoming the course labourer on Twitter, right, Ross? I mean, those sort of things do come out and can completely sort of overtake a very kind of rational discussion. And towards the end of this, you know, thinking about where we are in this sort of fictional game week 13, at this point in the week, we are, you know, starting to kind of be brought along by these sort of bandwagons, aren't we? And you know, these narratives, which didn't previously exist, suddenly start to, you know, permeate people's minds. And when you're thinking about where you're hovering your transfer, suddenly, you know, the Twitter groupthink option is up there with the one which was kind of the more of a rational, cold-minded pick that you're thinking up beforehand.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the bit that we can give you all the advice and you can get advice on anyone. You can read the books, you can listen to the podcast, but this is the point where you need to make the decision yourself. And this is where it becomes difficult. And this is the point where the advice can only go so far. You need to consider the choices you made at the start of the week. You need to consider confirmation bias, belief bias, sunk cost fallacy, groupthink, herd mentality. You need to collate all of this information and make the decision. And at some point you will make mistakes and that's how you learn. And mistakes is part of FPL. And I'll be very surprised if you don't make mistakes. And if you think you don't make mistakes, again, you're probably suffering from bias blind spot.
Indeed. I think this really nicely leads us on to what to believe. Do you trust your gut? Ross Dowsett said in his book, The Mind Game, since the dawn of man, emotions have been the primary tools used to aid and drive decision making. And later says he's a big advocate of trusting your gut feeling. I found myself agreeing with, obviously Ross is Ross, with your conclusion, Ross, that gut works well as a deciding factor when your research comes out as 50-50. And I like how you said, flip a coin if you just aren't sure. We've all been in that situation before. But I mean, do you guys all agree with this in terms of gut? I mean, Simon, you said in the past to me, my gut actually isn't a fan sport expert, so I'm not too sure about that. What's your view on gut?
I think there's a very sort of romantic concept behind it. This idea of, you know, the true answer, the correct answer, you know, lies within ourselves. And it's just a case of sort of teasing it out. Despite the discussion that we just had, there are more objective things like statistics, for example, are always going to be more objective. But I think that gut, even though I'm not a great believer in it, I do think that it gets a bit of a bad rap sometimes, because I think that there are times or certain circumstances where going with your gut just cuts through a lot of the nonsense, you know, some of which we've described, you know, some of the biases. You're just cutting all that out. And there are examples of this. There are people that really believe in this as you know, gut instinct, as a sort of heuristic or a shorthand for making complex decisions. Like one example that I really like is you'll read all these stories of firemen, you know, really experienced veteran firemen pulling their teams out of a burning building moments before it collapsed, because they just knew, whether they could verbalize it or explain it or not, they just knew that it was going to collapse. And that was their experience all coming together to influence what was really quite a subconscious decision, a gut feeling. And I think that you can have that in FPL, but I think you have to be very realistic with yourself about it. If you're a very experienced FPL manager, there is a good chance that you have seen a lot of scenarios that might actually beneficially influence your instincts. Your instincts will probably get better over time. But the counterpoint to that is that you can, you know, trust yourself too much. And so I think you do need to sense check them. And the ideal will always be to say, okay, is there an objective reason for this? Is there objective data that can support this gut feeling?
Yeah, I think it brings it back to, you know, what Ross said about it being a bit of a deciding factor.
Yeah, I don't think it should be used to drive a decision. So I don't think at the start of the week you should say my gut feeling at the start of the week is to, because then you're suffering with anchoring bias, plan continuation bias. I think you should do your research, use the eye test, use statistics. And when you arrive at that final decision, if there's not a clear favorite or a clear leader, I think that's the time when using your gut feeling can be very successful. I have presented the evidence in the book that it could be this synthesis of diverse experiences, gut feeling, and it could be something going on in our subconscious. It could be that we just recognize these things without processing them consciously. But I think the main reason that using your gut feeling is so successful is it just leads to greater enjoyment of the game. There's nothing worse than thinking I should have captained that player. My gut feeling was to captain that player, but I listened to the masses instead. I listened to the herd.
Yeah.
And there's two issues there. Number one, you'll be unhappy with yourself and you're not learning to trust yourself. And the second issue you'll have is that you'll start to resent the people in the community. And you don't want to resent the people that are making threads and helping you, because they're trying to help you in the community. That's what we're trying to do. So you don't want to resent them because they're going against your gut feeling. So yeah, so the narrative with the book was trust it, don't trust it. But I personally think that it will lead to greater enjoyment of the game if in some occasions when there is a 50-50 call, you learn to trust your gut.
This is interesting because something I found throughout my time as an FPL manager, first of all, and maybe then as an FPL content producer, I think I'm 6 or 7 years or something on Twitter now doing it. So a fairly long amount of time to draw as well. Something I've found is that when I do research on FPL, there's a point at the very start where my gut feel, you know, drives me towards a decision and it tends to be quite good. Then there's a point where I do research. And if I do a bit of research, but not lots of research, I find that things go wrong. But once I've done an absolute ton of research and come out the other end of this inverse curve, my decision-making tends to come out well again. And so frequently I find that I end up agreeing with my gut feeling was originally at the very end of this like long tangential story. And, you know, in one way, I'm quite fortunate that I've been able to do that for a season on end, because I've been producing like stuff like this, being a part of a co-host on a podcast, I've been writing articles and things. So I kind of have the chance and sometimes the monetary spur to go on and actually do loads of research to, you know, actually get to that point. Sometimes I don't have the time, and unfortunately then it tended to go poorly. And I've had quite a few seasons where it went poorly because I might have had that time to get to the end of that curve, you know, more game weeks than not. At the other end of this, though, I find it really interesting what Simon was saying, the idea that there is this romanticism to the use of the gut feeling that, you know, that the truth might be within ourselves and that that's maybe something that we can't hope for. But I guess what you're getting at, Ross, is that like it might not be the truth that's within us, but maybe there's some modicum of contentment in finding the answers within ourselves en route to finishing our FPL seasons. And there's a beauty in that. Kind of reminds me of Brian Clough turning around in that famous interview that he had after being sacked from Derby, saying that, you know, he's not an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me, as he put it. And, you know, it's that idea kind of sums it up so nicely. And I think that's what you're getting at when you say that it makes it more enjoyable.
Certainly. There's definitely, as you mentioned, an integrative approach, though. I mean, there may be all these times where your gut has done well to begin with, but that perhaps is one of those things that you remember the good things rather than the bad things. And maybe this links into availability heuristic, my favorite heuristic slash bias, the fallacy of the gut, almost we could say. This is where your most salient or easily retrievable memories can play an outsized role in your perceptions. So if a player scores, you know, 2 goals in 2 games, and you ask, okay, can you keep this up? Is he worth me buying in? Most people say, yeah, of course. Look at Jamie Vardy's streak from 15-16. You know, look at Jaylings. Of course he could do that. Of course he's worth buying in. But quantitatively, and as Simon said in the last podcast that we did with him, this is total rubbish. Most of the time, there's no such thing as a continuing run of form. See also players who hit the ground running in FPL. We remember the likes of Michu and Mo Salah, and take that as a reason to buy in the likes of Timo Werner in game week 1, because we expect a similar sort of initial bang from them. I'm backing my guy to the hilt. Actually, often availability heuristic is leading us astray. And the majority of successful approaches over the last kind of few years, and the early game weeks especially, have been to stick to the known quantities because they are fully adapted to the league. This also happens in the transfer market. So the Yannick Vestergaard effect, I like to call it, is one of these kind of things that I bring up for availability. So whenever Yannick Vestergaard over the last 2 seasons has scored a goal, his price by 2 weeks has risen by 0.4 million or so. It happens. I don't know why. He's quite a big lad. I think that he'll get a JWP corner. He'll nod one in, and suddenly all of the less engaged managers will be buying this guy. It also happened a few years ago with the Stephen Ward phenomenon. He scored a goal and an assist in consecutive game weeks, and he rose from 4.5 million to 5.2 million within 4 weeks. He was a Burnley defender who offered nothing except clean sheets, but people were buying him in hand over fist. There's also links to something called survivorship bias, which is a concentration on things which make it pass criteria, such as, did he keep scoring? Rather than look at the filters for people who fell by the wayside. And there's so many of them, aren't there, Simon?
I mean, you definitely see it in FPL. You can more or less, at the end of a game week, work out who is going to be the most bought in players the following game week. And it'll almost always be, you know, the player that scored the most or the cheap player who, you know, outperformed his price. This is very much a availability heuristic or recall bias. It's the emphasis that we put on the most easily accessible piece of information, which obviously is going to be the most recent game week, but it distorts our ability to rationally interpret data. So as you say, Tom, a player will fluke a goal and, you know, it might be the only goal that he has ever scored in his professional career, and there'll be a surge of ownership.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Ross, what's your view on availability? Is it the fallacy of gut as I've positioned it?
I think this is the thing we need to be really careful of. Perhaps I don't do enough as a big advocate of gut feeling, is realizing what the source of the gut feeling is. And I think that's very difficult to do. But I think often the source will be availability or saliency bias. I mean, there's so many different biases in this area. But if you can acknowledge that the source isn't just because it's a very available thing, which is so difficult to do, it's probably the most difficult bias to avoid or heuristic to avoid, because heuristics are mental shortcuts. So that they're these quick things that you probably can't control. So you need to do some sort of post hoc evaluation after this bias has occurred. Can you spot it after you've engaged with the availability heuristic? Can you spot that that's the case? So yeah, I think this is one of the major drawbacks to gut feeling. And I think Tom's hit the nail on the head. Don't trust gut feeling without doing research alongside it.
And I think this kind of links nicely into kind of the next point here. So imagining you're looking at your transfers, you know, you're looking at your captain, and really often it comes down to one word, which is risk. Should I take the risk or should I play it safe? Am I risk averse or am I risk seeking? To characterize some FPL managers that you all know and love, players like I mentioned earlier, like Joe from Manchester Scout, Matthew Jones, famous for a tercel approach. You know, they value the impact of the possible downside above the upside. So they're all looking to be very conservative, small c, and make sure they've got the key players, the template players who form a threat. And maybe, you know, their kind of punts and inverted commas are always going to be sort of small scale. They're not going to be captioning outside the box. They're not going to be buying in players that are esoteric small loans versus players like late riser and maybe myself as well, to some extent, who are more risk seeking players who always look on the bright side. You always think about what you can gain rather than what you can lose. And Ross, this is definitely one of the things. I mean, there's a huge questionnaire in your book, isn't there, about whether people can, how people can characterize themselves in this way. And we do this on the pod too with Nick's favorite risk profiling podcast.
Rather than conclude with this, I think I'll caveat with it at the start, as Tom loves his caveats. I think you need to play your own game, and there is never going to, if someone tries to offer you an answer as to how risk averse or risk seeking you should be, I would avoid that person, and I would avoid trying to listen to them, because you need to play your own game. In certain scenarios, you can advise with how many risks to take, but both kind of techniques work. Joshua Ball, I think he maybe only took one or two hits across his season when he won FPL. And he said he often tried to avoid those shiny new toys, and he would never take hits. And we know that late riser has had his two top 100 finishes. So you can be successful by taking risk, and you can be successful by not taking risks. And I think what you need to do is you need to work out what suits your own personality, because the biggest issue you'll find is if there's an incongruence between the risk profile that you have in FPL and the risk profile that you have in your own life, because you have some sort of cognitive dissonance where your own brain is telling you, I shouldn't be taking a risk here. But in FPL, you're taking hits and taking loads of risks. If you've got that incongruence between the two, you'll start to slip up and you'll be taking risks at the wrong time. You won't be timing those risks well. You'll be taking too big of a risk. And that's when you'll start to struggle throughout the season. So I guess my major piece of advice here is to play to your own strengths. And if you're a risk taker, take risks. And if not, try to be a bit more risk averse.
I think that's definitely something that I've fallen prey to. I've been trying to be a risk-averse character, because that's the prevailing sort of narrative on Twitter, isn't it? To kind of follow the crowd, as we've said, that common knowledge effect. Whereas in fact, I'm probably a bit of a risk taker, and I say this every year. And you know, at the end of this year, I've done the same thing where I've kind of belatedly realized, oh, I better take some risks. And that's worked really well for me. So maybe that kind of works better. But kind of that kind of is counteracted by the fact that at the start of the season, I've fallen prey to the same thing I always do. I'm like, oh God, everyone's doing this. I better do it. All the things that we've already spoken about. Anthony?
I found it quite interesting reading Ross's book about how a lot of literature suggests that the peer pressure that comes with social situations pushes people towards risk-taking behaviors, which I guess actually contrasts with your experience, Tom. But that, you know, even the evidence that suggests that even just the presence of someone there can increase your desire to take risks. So there's basically more people often brings about more risk taking. I guess we can all maybe think of this in maybe social situations that we've seen play out or whatever, with people just doing barmy things that they'd never do if there was nobody around. And so it does make sense. But then there's something else maybe that I was thinking about. And it's just this idea that if you want to win FPL, and I think there's something fundamentally unsexy about entering a season hoping to come in the top 10K. I think you should enter a season hoping to win the bloody thing. And, you know, if you end up in the top 10K or worse along the way, then, you know, that's the way the game is. And there is an inevitability to, if you want to win, you have to take risks. And risks are just deviating from others in some way. And so maybe in contrast to what's happened with you, Tom, where you've ended up, you know, putting your risks all at the end when you're trying to play catch up and it's all gone tits up. Really, if you want to win, you need to front load your risks. But there's something much, much harder psychologically about front loading risk, because then you have that risk of ruining your whole entire season by going off on your own solo run, plowing your own furrow early on. And I was interested to hear you guys maybe like take that apart psychologically a little bit for me. That, okay, really, risk seeking is the way to deliver victory in the early time in the season. And yet at the same time, anyone's risk aversion would tell you that that's the time that you definitely don't want to fall behind, because there's a whole season left to go. It's a marathon, not a sprint, all the other cliches. Yeah. Pick this apart for me.
It's really interesting because there is a sort of tenor within game theory that says that if you are going to take a risk, then it's best to do it early, because if it, you know, goes tits up, then you've got the, yeah, the rest of the time to redeem it. And if it goes brilliantly, then you're giving yourself an advantage. So, I think there is a time and a place for risk taking. Literally, you know, there's a time. I think that if you are going to take risks, maybe it's less damaging to do it at the early part of the season But when you get to the end of the season, if you're in, you know, second place in your mini league or, you know, the whole thing, then yeah, absolutely take some risks. But I don't think that you necessarily, even though we kind of categorize ourselves into dullards and mavericks, I don't think you necessarily have to be one or the other. I think that what would be sensible is to look at risk and risks realistically. I see a lot of the time, you know, people will describe a move as, you know, high risk, high reward, as if they're the same thing. Whereas, you know, the reality is that the higher the risk, the less likely the reward. And so, you know, you do have to bear that in mind. You can't just look at it and sort of say, okay, well, if this pays off, then, you know, it's really going to work for me. You do have to take into account the possibility that it might not, and where that will leave you. Take informed risks, in other words.
Being informed would tell you that taking the risks early is the right way to do it. You know, even the fact that we kind of see statistically that the top 10K has really settled itself by about game week 10, game week 8, isn't it? That for the most part, nobody really falls in or falls out. Like, it's Hotel California from then on. You know, you can check in, but you can never leave or whatever. Like, that's pretty much what starts to happen at that one. Maybe it is your game week one team or that early wild card in game week three to just react to whatever it is that you feel is the requirement to do is nearly the way forward with risk rather than trying to play catch up at the end. It's quite interesting to me.
I guess just to round off this section, I like to try and remind myself that we shouldn't be thinking in binary terms. And I think that's what Simon was getting at. As individuals, we like to think yes or no, risk-taking, risk-averse, confirmation bias, no confirmation bias. And everything in life and in psychology in particular, or most things, tends to be on a spectrum of some kind. And this has started to come into play a lot in clinical psychology with autism spectrum disorder. And we've started to realize that people aren't one thing or another. It's not black or white. There is a gray area in between. But I think that is definitely something that we need to consider throughout this, is that you're not going to be one thing or another. There's not a yes or a no. So definitely try and find what suits you, but don't think that you have to be one or the other.
Definitely a scope to start singing some Michael Jackson there, but I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to destroy the sanctity of this really, really good podcast by doing so. But yeah, a really interesting section there, guys. And I think that there's quite a few things to bear in mind, as we've said, about framing to begin with. I think that's my big takeaway from all observations of FPL Twitter, just to bear in mind how people come at things and how people are presenting data. But some really interesting stuff about how you present yourself as a risk taker or not, and how the gut can either be a good or a bad thing, and how these things can influence the decisions we make. At this point of game week 13, we are at the point where we've made our decisions and we are about to kind of hit the deadline. It's you've locked your team and you're ready to go, and back after this small break to come into the last kind of couple of sections, which is in play and also post hoc after game week.
Who got the assist?
So we're back, and I guess at this point, you know, to set the scene again, it's game week 13 and we're in play. The deadline's gone, pens down, and we're strapped in for yet another game week. This game week 13, there's been lots of decisions to be made. There's lots of podcasts, articles and things to digest. But it's all over now and we need to see how it plays out. The first section here is looking at in play, and it'll be quite brief, but there's definitely a few things that can wash over managers cognitively as this kind of enjoyable start of the week where hope lives before it goes to die when the actual results come in. It can happen. Behaviours we see mostly are virtually, as we've mentioned a few times, you know, social media is a bit of a petri dish of how all these things sort of come together, be it on Twitter timeline or in those group chats. But I think one of the big things actually that I see is anticipated regret in how people talk about what happens, especially before things kick off, but after the line has hit. There's a man called Marcel Zeelenburg at Tilburg University in the Netherlands, who is literally the regret king academically. He for some reason has, you know, staked his entire career on looking at regret, the emotion of regret. And he characterizes regret as a counterfactual emotion. He says that regret is a rather complex emotional experience and that it both stems from and produces higher order cognitive processes. Freedom regret requires the ability to imagine other possibilities than the current state of the world. One has to reflect on one's choices and the outcomes generated by those choices. But one also has to reflect on what other outcomes might be obtained by making a different choice. So there's so many things there which definitely sort of, you know, take us out of the present and into the future and projecting onto that future. And what this means in terms of fantasy football management, so when the deadline has gone or just before, you know, a game starts, we see, oh, I should have bought X, he's starting now. Oh, why didn't I captain Y? You know, the opposition looks like they're tailor-made for his sort of game. I think it's fascinating to see how, you know, this future-gazing psychological foible really manifests itself. You know, the event hasn't happened yet, but we're transposing a result and projecting what we think our emotions will be onto the future. A really fascinating sort of meta one. And I think, you know, Ross, we definitely see this, don't we? And the initial reactions to lineups and, you know, the big game of that game week, we definitely see people kind of minimizing perhaps what's going to happen in the future, or indeed kind of trying to kind of give themselves a sense of comfort about a potential result which could occur. And anticipated regret, I think, definitely plays a huge part in the in-play element of a game week.
Yeah, absolutely. And that 90 minutes following the deadline can be, still used to be an hour, but that 90 minutes following the deadline before that first game can be a long 90 minutes as you're scrolling through Twitter, that idea of regret and seeing everyone else's teams and you're looking for that confirmation bias. Has anyone else brought in the same player that I have? Is anyone else captaining that differential? And that regret starts flooding in that kind of, I suppose, before in play, but after you've made your decisions, that initial stage of the game week. And I guess I'd like to bring in here the idea of illusion of control, because it's helped me a lot with my, I wouldn't say issues, but I do struggle to switch off once the game week starts, and I'm constantly checking my team and I'm constantly checking live FPL, and I want to know what my rank is and I want to know if I've captained that player with the what if function on live FPL net now. And I'm always interested in these things. But what we do need to realize is we don't have control over the outcome. As soon as you've entered your team, that is it. You've got your score. You can't do anything once you've entered your team. The players need to perform for you. So this idea of illusion of control is the idea that we don't actually, we think we have control over an event we don't have control over. And that is the case with FPL. And I used to do the same during my bachelor's. I used to try and think, right, I've put my pen down in the exam hall. I've finished my exam. That's it. I've got my grade. I know it hasn't been marked yet, but I can't do anything else after I've written that exam. And it's the same in FPL. And I think that comes in with the regret idea. Try not to regret it. Try not to have this anticipated regret. Realize that you can't control anything after you've submitted your team. And there's nothing you can do after that fact.
Yeah, I think we've spoken a lot on this podcast in the past when it came to, you know, the old trope of luck versus skill. A lot of FPL is putting yourself in a position to get lucky. So you've done all the right research, you've gone through all the proper processes, as it were. And at the end of the day, it's just, will it be all right on the night, or will it be all right during the game week? I mean, Simon, is this something that impacts you as an FPL manager?
Oh, yeah, definitely. In fact, I mean, I'm interested to hear that people actually start a game week and don't feel regret. It feels to me like it's just the kind of standard. But I can really relate to a lot of this myself, as, you know, somebody that has quite severe obsessive compulsive disorder. I definitely find myself doing that kind of magical thinking things that I can somehow, you know, influence what's going to happen in the game week, and that's really kind of affected me quite a lot and my enjoyment of the game. I think, you know, for the way that I look at it, you know, I look at it, I actually use FPL as a way of sort of challenging that, of not, you know, doing the sort of weird, you know, ritualistic kind of things that OCD sufferers tend to do. But what I think you ultimately want to get to is a point where you've made a decision, and it's a decision, you know, that you can live with, that you can justify to yourself, whatever the outcome is. And that's very much a case of, you know, we talk about outcome bias sometimes, the tendency to judge something based on the outcome. But if you can judge something based on the logic that went into making the decision, then, you know, that's a far easier to cope with, and, you know, makes you much more accountable, I think, for your own actions, which is something that will benefit you in the future. Just quickly, one thing that I'd really recommend is not looking at your rivals' teams until, you know, the game week is finished at best, because it will just wreck your game week. because whatever you've done, you can see your players and they might score, and, you know, you can feel really good about that, and you'll get all the enjoyment that you might typically get from that. but all it will take is for their differential to do well as well. And that just completely undermines everything that you experience. And ultimately, at the end of the day, even though, you know, we take it more seriously than perhaps most people do, it is a game. It's supposed to be fun. And you know, sometimes I think you have to kind of manage that and you know, manage the anticipated regret that you might have, and maybe kind of insulate yourself from it a bit.
So as part of managing anticipated regret, Simon, do you now try to ignore EO as well? Because that's definitely something that has become more and more pervasive in the last two seasons. And now we're starting to see, you know, the amount of damage against you, how you know, a player getting a point will do to your rank and all this sort of thing. Do you just avoid all of those tools completely?
Well, no, I'm absolutely addicted to, you know, to some of them. I'm the same as yeah, anybody that comes across them. And it's a really weird one, because it's great when your player's scored and you can go on there and you can look at the impact that it's had on your rank. And,
yeah, you can literally count the change as it's coming in. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's worth it on that level. But yeah, I'm sure that there are negatives. It's something that you know, that I would like to maybe write an article about or something and see, you know, does it change the way that we play it? Does it change the way that we assess things? But occasionally I'll do the match of the day challenge, which, if, you know, people, listeners haven't heard of it, is the idea of you avoid hearing anything about any of the matches just watch match of the day in the evening. And then you get the, you know, the triumph and despair all in, you know, one quick dose. I actually find I really enjoy that. I really enjoy it sometimes when I'm just out and I can't, you know, look at my phone or whatever, for whatever reason, I can't follow the football. I'm at a wedding or something like that. I actually really enjoy it when, you know, you can just kind of check it all in one go, you know, later on. And if it's good news, then, you know, it's still good news. If it's bad news, then, you know, at least you only have to experience it once rather than it be drip fed to you across the entire day or weekend.
Yeah, and this season has been like, you know, the hose has been slightly broken and the dripping has been, you know, even more incremental than usual with the way the game weeks were drawn out because of COVID, which made that little bit worse. And a match of the day challenge, a, like, you know, 10-day process, or, when that's an exaggeration, a 5-day process.
Yeah, I remember when I was in Australia, it was great because I used to, you know, wake up in the morning and you could see all the outcomes because I was asleep when the games were going on. And it was just fantastic because, as you said, there was no sort of, you know, staging post throughout the week where, oh, this is great, you know, I'm doing really well. Oh no, actually the high owned player I don't own has absolutely smashed it and now my rank is through the floor. I mean, it was really, really useful from that regard to kind of do that. I was just remembering kind of what we said about illusion of control, effective ownership and illusion of control. Do you think that people kind of making their decisions transfer wise based on ownership or the forecast of that kind of effective ownership kind of helps them to retain this illusion of control? So they think, you know what, I've at least kind of made steps to negate the downside of what could have happened. And I'm, you know, even though I can't control what happens, I've still got the players to try to make sure that, you know, I've got some element of grasp over the outcome I get from this game week.
Yeah, absolutely. And part of the illusion of control theory and cohort of literature suggests that we do try and take control where we can. It's not only that we have this illusion that we have control, but when we can find a nugget of information or a piece of our week or life where we can take control, we will take control of that. And that's where it becomes obsessive. The things that we can control, which is that prior part of the research or looking at EO, that's why we start to obsess over these things, because these are the things we feel like we can control. But ultimately, using EO can be helpful to try and counter certain things, but again, it's not going to affect much. The real thing you should be choosing is which players you think are going to perform.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that before we move on to post hoc, I think there's one bit of the in play which is pervasive on social media and pervasive amongst, you know, all the WhatsApp groups you'll all be in for fantasy football: hindsight bias. Everyone be familiar with this. I knew it. Creeping determinism. It basically cuts through the uncertainty, and it basically means that people act like events were far more predictable than they actually were. Like, we're all very guilty of this one time or another, you know, kind of just, you know, positively saying, oh, I knew this guy's going to perform. I brought him in and, you know, I'm now reveling in the fact that I've got those points. When in fact, you know, he's just bummed the chance in and he's got a house assist from, you know, the 45 yards out. He's passed it to someone who's got an amazing solo dribble and scored. And you've got a golden assist. Hey, presto. And it could also punch negatively too. So you can say, oh yeah, I knew that my captain was going to blank. And, you know, it's a bit, it's comforting, isn't it? You know, it's motivationally, you know, it's very comforting to think, oh, well, it was inevitable that he'd bang as in captain him or own him or whatever. And this, interestingly, has actually been proven to be true. So Dietrich and Olsen in 1993 asked college students in the US, it always seems to be college students in the US, which is a whole different thing. But anyway, they asked them to predict how likely the US Senate would confirm a Supreme Court judge called Clarence Thomas. Before his confirmation, only 58% of students predicted that he would be confirmed to go in. They then repeated this experiment afterwards. And afterwards, 78% of students said that he'd be confirmed to go in to the Supreme Court. So it just kind of shows how hindsight can change, alter, and make people think that events are far more predictable, as I said, than they actually were. And Ross, we see this all the time, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd just like to say that trusting your gut here will help reduce hindsight bias, because a part of hindsight bias is the idea that we look back and we said, oh, I knew that would happen, or I knew I shouldn't have done that. That's why it's also termed the knew it all along effect, is sort of like the colloquial term for it. And if we trust our gut feeling in those 50-50s, we're less likely to say, oh, I knew it would go that way, because we're trusting it. And if we knew it, then we would have gone for that decision. So that's another nice benefit of trusting your gut in those 50-50 calls. In it's less likely, you're less likely to activate hindsight bias and outcome bias.
So let's move on to the final part of this then. The game week is now over. Yep, our game week 13 has come to a close. However you did, you're probably picking over the wreckage of it. You're looking at what went right, what went wrong. And before the cycle starts all over again, you know, you start listening to podcasts again, you start reading reports, and you start doing whatever you do in the early stages. It's worth going over the psychological impacts that the aftermath of a game week can have on you as a manager. How can I tell how well I've done? Simon mentioned this earlier, outcome bias is a massive impact on so many people's perspective on how they did during a game week. We did this on the podcast back in the Project Restart sort of time. Outcome bias of resulting in poker is, simply put, the tendency to evaluate the quality of a decision based on the outcome rather than the thought process. People who succeed are assumed to have made best decisions than those who have failed. In life, as an FPL, this means that people have made the right decision, easy to be cautious, not risk it, as that works the majority of the time, but failed or punished more than those who took irresponsible risks that happen to work out, e.g., you know, captaining a mad pick that pays off. There's a UPenn experiment on this, which used a legal case to ask subjects whether the city, a random city in America, of course, should have done certain preventative actions like flood risks. When exposed to the evidence the city had at the time, 24% of people said that they should have taken the action to, you know, mitigate against floods. But when exposed to the outcome the action was supposed to prevent, this rose to 56% of people. So more people after the fact there was a flood said, you know what, these guys should have probably, you know, prevented against a flood. Shocking, right? And I think we've kind of touched on this a few times. But the governing principle for me, it's peace of mind when it comes to outcome assessment. Obviously, there is in kind of the cadence of FPL a right and a wrong, because the points are the points and your rank is your rank. But I guess psychologically, in terms of feeling comfort of how things have gone, you can always kind of pull yourself apart when you ask yourself, was it the right decision? Because yes or no, it becomes very, very blunt, doesn't it? I think actually to make yourself kind of feel better, or at least kind of help you kind of continue on with the season, or at least be able to have that kind of resilience to kind of think, you know what, I've had a bad game, but I'll continue on. The better question, rather than was it the right decision, to ask yourself is probably, am I happy with the decision I've made? It's an attempt to put maybe structure on the randomness, remembering again clustering illusion, hindsight bias. But I think that, you know, outcome bias is definitely one of those things which pervades a lot of kind of post hoc analysis of what happened in the game week. And actually, you know, you can loll at somebody who's done something which hasn't paid off. But if it was an outlandish punt, then fair enough. But if it was something which did have kind of a backing to it, you went for everything, either there's gut feeling which kind of pushed them there, and or there were kind of underlying objective reasons to do a thing, it's important to, I think, Simon, to look at outcome bias and kind of think how that kind of outcome actually isn't a bad thing in some ways.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, part of this is really making yourself feel better about the decision that you've made. But there is a really sort of practical element to it in that if you assess all your decisions based on outcomes, then that is going to start to influence how you make decisions in the future. And if that outcome was not objectively realistic and you spend, you know, your next game weeks trying to capture that or predict this thing happening again, it's much more likely that you're going to miss every time. And so I think it really benefits you to be able to look at your decisions and say, all right, have I reached this conclusion? Even if it turned out to be wrong, have I reached this decision in a logical way? And if I have, you know, was I just unfortunate or was there a flaw in my methodology, in my process? And looking at it in, you know, through that lens means that it actually becomes a beneficial process, so something that actually enhances your ability and makes you a better manager over time. You know, it takes that disappointment and actually repurposes it and says, okay, well, I've learned something from this. In terms of a quick exercise that you can do, is to sort of say, okay, if you look at the outcome, what would you have had to have done to have predicted this outcome? And that can be quite a useful process in terms of both, one, making yourself feel better about something, because there's a good chance that, you know, via this exercise, you'll find out that you couldn't have predicted this outcome or not reasonably. And secondly, it will allow you to look at your own process and your own methodology in a more critical way. And yeah, as I say, this is a way of improving your ability as a decision-making FPL manager.
Yeah, so just to build on what Simon said, I think one of the main things is there's going to be a high amount of variance in the outcome. And I think that's a very big thing, is one week you'll make exactly the same decision and it'll have a very, very different outcome to the next week. So with the amount of variance there are in outcomes, I think it's very difficult to try and work out what you've done well and what you haven't. So last season, I sold Luke Shaw and Bruno Fernandes before Man United played against Liverpool. And I know Bruno got a 10-pointer and Shaw got a 15-pointer. Man United were about to go on a very, very difficult run. We didn't look like we were going to perform very well against Liverpool. That was the right decision to make. Luke Shaw was very unlikely to keep a clean sheet and score a goal. I was happy with my decision and I was at peace with it because the decision-making process was correct. Obviously, it angered me slightly that I just lost 25 points, but trying to focus on the decision-making process, as Simon said, and not on the outcome is the key thing here. And you will be more at peace with your decisions if you do that.
25 points, wow. Oh, yeah, it's always good to have that sort of level of comfort, at least some psychological angle, if you have that sort of massive variance in the outcome.
Interesting one there, Ross. You discussed variance. That's something that's come up in the other Summer Specials pod, which looks at more quantitative aspects and statistical aspects of FPL, and maybe ties in with the broader point around kind of this whole entire area of outcome bias. And I ask myself, and I'm throwing this question to any of the three of you, really, at what point does analysing decision-making and maybe ignoring the outcome, and in this sense, probably pointing to variance, intrude on logic? Like, for example, last season, Kevin De Bruyne continued to get good chances. He continued to register good shots in the box stats. His XG was quite good too. There came a point, and I don't know where that point was, and I guess that's what the crux of this question is. There came a point where it was more logical to sell him in spite of his statistical outcomes because the outcome wasn't good enough in FPL points, in spite of everything. And how do we identify that? And I know, Simon, you gave an interesting way of deciphering how we could have went about predicting what went on and what drove, you know, in this case, what drove you mad about, you know, your outcomes in FPL, but not necessarily your decision-making. But how can we try to identify that point where outcomes intrude on logic to a point that we're going wrong from an FPL perspective?
What I would say with respect to this is that nobody is capable of being entirely rigidly logical. You know, the whole premise of everything that we've been talking about, the biases and everything, comes from that flaw in us as human beings. But equally, that is the discipline that we're talking about, that it won't always be easy and it won't always necessarily produce the right outcome. You know, sometimes the logical decision won't be the most beneficial one, but that's sort of something that you kind of have to accept in the belief that over a long enough period of time, you will come out on top.
Yeah, I think that is probably the crux of it, because I guess I knew in asking my question what I was asking you is like, where would a crystal ball owner, you know, succeed ahead? You know, it's like it is an impossible question. So I fully understand that. And it's, I guess maybe this chimes in with what Tom had said, that, you know, it is quite easy to just laugh at people pointing to variants sometimes, you know, who are kind of clung to a belief based on statistics or based on hunches or based on whatever other bias that might come into things. But I guess it shows you the risk, the chance, the probability nature of FPL, that at the end of the day, we really don't know what's going to happen next. And, you know, things occur, and that is football. And I guess that's why we like the sport at the end of the day too.
Absolutely. And I think that level of outcome as well can lead to an open question about how we deal with bad game weeks. And I'm going to pass to you here, Ross, because you've had a couple of sort of really good tips on coping or kind of self-distancing from the outcomes, especially when they're bad ones. And the good ones, you know, you kind of float on okay. But I think if it's a bad game week, it can be quite difficult to kind of get to the point where you dust yourself off and sort of continue on, right?
Absolutely. I think this is a really important point, because the point of FPL is to enjoy it. And we can talk about all of these cognitive biases and if you fall victim to this bias and this fallacy, and if you fall victim to groupthink. But if you're enjoying FPL and you regularly suffer from groupthink, herd mentality, confirmation bias, but you're enjoying yourself, doesn't matter. If you're happy with doing what you want to do, then that's the most important thing. So one of the main things that I always try to tackle, and I always am happy to discuss on Twitter, is how can we increase our enjoyment of the game? Or probably more importantly, how can we reduce the negativity associated with the game? Because it is an inherently enjoyable game. We shouldn't have to increase the enjoyment aspect. We love football. We love moving little shirts around the pitch. We should inherently enjoy it. So it's how do we sort of mitigate the negative impact of FPL? So I guess the first thing to consider is, why do we experience negative emotions and negative feelings? And the main thing is because it's so immediate and so present. We're so enveloped by the game week that we're in, or we're sitting there on a Saturday, we're scrolling through Twitter, we're watching football. We've been spending 4 hours a day all week sort of drafting our teams and making our decisions. It becomes part of our world and part of our daily thoughts. And we're so enveloped in that here and now, in the emotion, in the immediate situation, that it can be very, very difficult to detach ourselves from that. So it's very intense. So the key method for dealing with the negative emotions is to try and detach yourself, to try and distance yourself. And that's where we get self-distancing, not to be mistaken with social distancing. So self-distancing, yeah, you detach yourself from the current situation. It's also called psychological distancing. Sometimes you'll see in the literature. Essentially, you're mentally separating yourself from the immediate situation and you're trying to see the bigger picture. So you can imagine physically, you're trying to pick yourself up, take yourself out of that bubble that you're in, and then put yourself somewhere else and imagine what it would be like in the future. So by detaching ourselves from the current situation and by psychologically distancing ourselves, we're basically trying to make our reasoning improve. So we're trying to reason more with the emotions that we're experiencing during the game week. So the best way to do this is to have a series of statements. So I have a few of these on my phone. I'll admit I struggle with this. So I regularly try and use my own advice.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah. So I have a list of statements on my phone, and it will say things such as, it will use game week 13. In 1 year time, will I be worrying about my captaincy fail in game week 13? Right? And the answer should be no. It might be in 1 year time, you might be worrying about game week 13, but it's unlikely. If that doesn't work, you can then extend that. In 5 years time, will I be caring about my 2021 season in FPL? No, you won't be. You probably won't even be caring about an FPL in 5 years. You might be. But you can start to see, if you try and detach yourself from the situation and consider the bigger picture and the future picture, you can start to realize that FPL isn't everything. And it's not this intense, immense game that has to worry us at every turn. And I think this is useful because whilst the crux of this is it's just a game, if you're someone that suffers with negative emotions during the game week, the worst thing that someone can say to you is, oh, don't stress, it's just a game. That can really hurt, because for us, it's not just a game. And obviously, if that worked by saying it's just a game, then we wouldn't be experiencing these emotions. So it's not just a game. It's a very important part of our lives. But what we can do is try and detach ourselves from that and consider the bigger picture in the future.
Yeah, I'm still thinking about decisions I made in back in 2008. So yeah, looking forward to the time when I finally get over those. But I think, yeah, speaking of social distancing, distancing yourself from social, I think, is a really sensible idea if you've had a bad game week, because you will constantly see people who've had a great game week. And because it's self-selecting, I mean, people tend to only talk about their scores when they've been good. You get a sort of survivorship bias or a selection bias. it will give the impression that everybody else did really, really well and you did really, really badly. And that's really unlikely to be the truth. So sometimes I think the best thing to do is to just stay off forums, stay off social media, you know, let it sink in a little bit. And, you know, in a couple of days, you probably will feel fine and you'll be thinking about the next game week anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the one more thing just to bear in mind before we round off is future projection bias, which is a behavioral science trope that you can't project how you're feeling now onto a time in the future, which I think oddly actually gives you hope. It's a sense of myopia. Like you're always able to shift and change emotionally as a human being, which means the disappointment of a bad game week can give way to hope that the next one will be better. Or the sheen of a good game week can be tempered into a steely determination that this will continue. And you won't always be able to forecast how you feel, but you know you're going to feel differently. I think taking this kind of in general, we know innately that emotion changes throughout time, but we're unable to truly feel, according to future projection bias, how we are going to feel in the future. It just doesn't happen. You know, I can't imagine feeling happy when I'm sad. I can't imagine feeling excited when I'm, you know, feeling a bit meh about things. It's very hard to put yourself in the shoes of you in the future. But building on that, knowing that in the future, your mindset will shift and you will be excited again, despite at the time feeling a bit upset, is something that I think everyone should take to drive you forward. It's been a fascinating chat, and I think it's probably now time to just summarize, I guess, maybe what we've learned from this chat. I know it's obviously a bit of a tall order for us all to do, but I'd like us to anyway, just the sort of things that, you know, we're taking away from this and that perhaps could, you know, to project outwards, could help managers throughout the next season, or indeed, whenever you listen to this, for the season that you're playing in. Simon, let's go with you first. I mean, what sort of things do you think from talking about the impacts of, you know, psychology and behavioral science or whatever, however you want to put it, in FPL, have you taken from this?
One of the major impacts, I think, is how much how you feel about things or how you make decisions is reflected in other people. Even though we might have very different approaches to this game, there are certain commonalities between the way we approach it, the way it affects us. And I think that there's something actually quite comforting about that, even though it's important to manage your biases and sense check your decisions. Ultimately, you do have to own your own decisions. If it's going to be fun at all, it has to be a reflection of your own identity, of your own personality. And really, that is what makes it interesting, rather than, you know, this idea that we could all be sort of automatons, all making perfect decisions all the time.
In this sense, actually, if you were to internalize all of the advice that you've heard in this pod, it would be asking you to stay dynamic and open, to do all of your own research really as much as you can, or certainly if you read some research, to try and get an alternative aspect to that, to try and read more into things. And once you've come to a decision, question yourself, why did you come to that decision? And so in so many ways, psychology has a role to play in FPL, more so than just in our individual decision making, but in how we go about everything to do with FPL beyond just your transfer and your captain in a given week.
I think all of those are good points. And I think I would reiterate that it's very important to try and reflect introspectively and always try and adapt and be dynamic and realize that we all have room to improve. Even if you are an expert at something, you can always learn more. And I think being open-minded is something that I would encourage to everyone in every aspect of life. Never be closed-minded. Never think you stop learning. So that's important. But I suppose my number one would always be to enjoy the game. Be active and persistent in your pursuit of trying to find ways to enjoy the game. If it's doing the match of the day challenge, if it's looking at psychology, if trying to work out how your biases affect you, if you really enjoy that, which I do, then do that. If you enjoy stats, use stats. If you enjoy only the mini league aspect, try not to look at your overall rank. Find the thing that will improve the way that you perceive the game. And like I said, be persistent, be determined. Don't just accept the game. Don't accept the fact that you're not enjoying it. Oh, it's part of FPL. If I have a bad game week, I'm not going to enjoy it. Don't accept that. You should be enjoying this game. It is a game at the end of the day. So yeah, my main tip and something which has come up again during this podcast is just enjoy yourself wherever you can.
Absolutely. I think in summary, do we even have one? I think that everybody will take their own takeaway from this, be it, you know, something that we've said,
something which chimes with you, a certain sort of foible of that we've documented and identified that you think, oh, actually, there's a whole realm of cognitive biases that can impact you as an FPL manager. As Anthony inferred, you know, are we the econs for saying, you know, all of these things all exist out there, so you need to, you know, be good in terms of dodging these? No. Often we can't find time due to life to make a pristine dodge of all of these sort of biases and heuristics out there, despite us detailing what these all are. Adapt and be dynamic, as Ross says. But I guess the point in doing this pod overall was to both provide you with an interesting and hopefully simulated conversation surrounding these, and just help ladder up understanding so you're more aware, observing bias blind sort of course, of the behaviours and thought processes you may go through during your FPL season. I think that rounds us our discussion very, very nicely. I want to thank our guests who are absolutely brilliant. First is Ross at FPL underscore Raptor. His book, The Mind Game, is out now. Highly recommended. We've all read it and we absolutely loved it. Thanks for coming on, Ross. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much, Tom and Anthony, and also Simon. It's been a pleasure. Like I said, I've been reading Simon's and your own articles in the past on the psychology, and it's great to get into a call and all discuss it. And we all love it as much as each other. So it's been enjoyable. I'd do this not even on a podcast. I'd love to just have a bit of you and just sit and chat psychology. So it's been great.
It's been a bit of a privilege to do it. And obviously, Simon, at Mark Simon on Twitter, preferred appearance now, of course, but every time it's been the same as Ross has described. It's just great to talk about it, isn't it? And thanks so much for coming on and sharing your thoughts on this.
Thanks for having me. I've really enjoyed it. And yeah, good luck with the book, Ross.
Thanks very much to both of you guys for coming on. It was an absolute pleasure to discuss it. And I guess coming from the perspective of more of a layman, I thought it was really enlightening, number one, to read Ross's book in the process of reading ahead of this podcast, and then actually discussing with you guys and trying to put meat on the bones of the different ideas. It was really, really interesting. And I hope that other lay people and experts alike who are listening to this really, really enjoyed listening to this pod. And with that, thanks so much for listening. This was Who Got the Assist? You've been listening to a summer special podcast that was recorded during the summer prior to the 2021-2022 season. So if you've enjoyed this, I would recommend you to listen to us during the regular season too for slightly different but equally informative content. Don't forget to hit the subscribe button if you haven't already.
Yeah, thanks so much for listening. One other thing, the FPL London Summer Meetup, 24/7, 24th of July, Saturday. All guidelines permitting, it looks like it will be a normal event. So make sure you get yourself down there. It's the Editor's Tap, Fetter Lane, London. If you can make it, do. We'll be there for 3 p.m. onwards, which will be a really amazing event. We're doing that with Planet FPL and also the guys from Surgery, and we cannot wait for the day. So definitely try to come along to that if you can. Really, really looking forward to it. This was the Behavioral Science and FPL pod. Next week, it's fandom and FPL, and data analytics and FPL is to come. We hope we assist you, and we'll speak to you very, very soon. Goodbye.
Oh, it's a goal. Who got the assist? Who got the assist?
Sports Social Podcast Network.